Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcast on rheumatoid arthritis. Today I will be talking to Dr. Danny Murphy, GP partner, staff grade rheumatologist and Versus Arthritis MSK champion. We will be talking about the diagnosis and management of rheumatoid arthritis or RA. To start with, Danny, could you give us a bit of an introduction into the basic pathology of RA and why it's important that the diagnosis is made early?
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you for inviting me on. It's really nice to be here. I think it's important, first of all, to define what we're talking about. So we're talking about inflammatory arthritis. So this is autoimmune inflammatory arthritis. This isn't osteoarthritis. This isn't crystal arthritis, which we'd call gout. This is arthritis that's driven by your body's immune system misrecognizing your own body's proteins in and around joints and the synovium as foreign and mounting an autoimmune response to that. And what we know about these type of arthritis is that the earlier we catch it, the better patients do. We talk about this concept of a window of opportunity. So within about the first 3 months of somebody developing symptoms, we've got about 3 months to really intervene early and hard and potentially turn some of those genes off that drive the disease. We know that if we can treat people aggressively and early within that window of opportunity, we can very rapidly turn the disease off. We can get people into remission very quickly. And there are really good studies that show that if we can do that, potentially a third of patients can get into what we call drug-free remission, so can stop their treatment if we treat them aggressively and early. But even if we can't do that, patients do better. So the earlier we get patients onto treatment, the quicker we can settle their symptoms down, the quicker they can get back to work and normal life. They're much less likely to have erosions and joint damage, which we can't undo. They're much less likely to have functional impairments, so they're more likely to stay in work. They're more likely to be able to care for dependents. And they're much less likely to get some of the other things that we can see with rheumatoid. So we think about cardiovascular disease and some disease outside the joints. So it's really important that we get people onto treatment as quickly as we can.
Thank you very much. So joint pain is a common presentation in general practice. The majority of patients with joint pain probably won't have RA in the same way as the majority of patients who present with any symptom in general practice often don't have pathology. So what things do you look out for in the history that particularly raise your suspicions of an inflammatory cause?
Yes, this is really difficult, isn't it? It's classic general practice. We know that inflammatory arthritis is a relatively uncommon cause of joint pain in primary care, something we see all the time. And yet it's something that I'm sitting here telling you that you've got to pick up. It's really important to pick up early. And it's really hard. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's straightforward. But there are some key things that we can come back to in history. And as I said, this is classic general practice. This is listening to the patient, listening to what they're telling you. So the first thing to think about is who gets inflammatory arthritis. Well, what we need to do is think about the patient sat in front of us. How old are they? It's not usual for young people to come in with new joint pain. So if you've got a young person sat in front of you who 3 weeks ago had no joint pain at all, and suddenly he's developed this subacute onset of very new joint pain, that's a red flag that rings and says, well, hang on, is this something that I should be thinking about? Is inflammatory arthritis a possibility here? But we do know that the commonest age for inflammatory arthritis to present is actually in the fifth or sixth decade of life. So we can't rely on age alone. So the first thing to think about is that onset. How long has the pain been there for? If this is pain that's been there for 6, 9, 12, 18 months and it's gradually increased, affecting maybe one or two joints, that makes inflammatory arthritis less likely. But if somebody's coming to you and saying, look, 3 weeks ago, I didn't have any pain in my hands at all, the odd ache and pain, but it goes away, and now I've developed persistent pain that I can't get rid of, that's a red flag. That's something that should make you think, hang on, is this something, is inflammatory arthritis a possibility here? And then we go back to things that we learned at medical school and as registrars, those key things that give us an idea as whether pain could be mechanical or inflammatory. Those classical symptoms. So we talk about early morning pain and early morning stiffness. We know that cortisol is a profoundly anti-inflammatory hormone. And our cortisol is really low in the middle of the night and first thing in the morning. And as we wake up, our circadian rhythm kicks in, our cortisol starts to rise. So inflammatory pain tends to be at its worst first thing in the morning. If you say to anybody over the age of 50 or 60, do you have pain when you first get up? They will all say yes. Pain and stiffness, we all get it, particularly if you've been exercising the day before. We've all experienced it. The key thing is how long for. So somebody with new inflammatory arthritis will say, actually, I really struggle for an hour or two. It takes me an hour or two to really get going. And then actually, as I get going through the day, that pain tends to get better and ease. I'm at my best in the middle of the day. And then in the evening, as I start to sit down and rest and watch Coronation Street, that pain and stiffness starts to come back and worsen. If somebody with osteoarthritis, mechanical arthritis, will often tell you exactly the opposite. Yes, they might have 10 to 20 minutes of stiffness when they first get up, but their pain in general is at its best first thing in the morning, tends to worsen as the day goes through, as they use their joint, and it tends to get better with rest, whereas inflammatory arthritis is exactly the opposite. I think the other thing that can really help with is pain and stiffness at night. We all think about nocturnal symptoms as being red flags, and I think that's true here. That pain that's waking somebody up in the middle of the night is a key symptom that can help us differentiate. Again, if you've got a sore knee or mechanical back pain, occasionally that might wake you up when you roll over, but what happens is you get back to sleep relatively quickly. It's short-lived. Whereas inflammatory pain affects you at that witching hour, that 3-4 o'clock in the morning when we've been working nights, when you feel absolutely awful because your cortisol's in your boots, that's when it wakes you up and you have to get up and move around to settle it down. So just to summarize that, you know, think about the patient in front of you. How did this pain come on? Has it been there for a long time and gradually getting worse, or is it relatively recent and subacute in onset? And we think about our key inflammatory features, the early morning stiffness, that pain that gets better with exercise and movement, that worsens with rest, and think about nocturnal pain.
Thank you very much. That's really useful. I think particularly what you said about not being put off by someone who has a little bit of morning stiffness, because as you say, most people will complain of that over a certain age.
Listen to that spidey sense. You know, it's that little red flag, that warning bell that rings. We all see thousands of patients a year. We are, you know, GPs are fantastic clinicians. We're amazing. Just thinking that there's something not right here. And I think what I would do is I would just listen to that. Just listen to that spidey sense, that warning bell that says, hang on, this doesn't quite fit. And if it doesn't quite fit, that's a trigger to say, is there something else driving this?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I've always listened to when my antennae twitch or my spidey sense. And I think there was recently something in the BJGP actually formalising that and saying that a GP gut feeling is something we really need to listen to. So it's nice to have it acknowledged. How would you go ahead assessing a patient with suspected RA remotely?
So I think in lots of ways, assessing a patient remotely doesn't really change what they do. But I was talking to colleagues yesterday, in lots of ways it makes it incredibly different. So how does it not change it? Well, this is all about the history. So history is incredibly important in everything we do, but particularly with inflammatory arthritis. You get 90% of your information from the history, and you can still do that over the telephone. You can still do that via video consultation. So going back to the things we talked about, that idea of subacute new onset pain affecting lots of joints, particularly the small joints of the hands, those classical inflammatory symptoms of early morning stiffness, early morning pain, pain that gets better with exercise, and nocturnal pain. So I think if on the basis of a history, you think, do you know what? I've been doing this a long time. I'm not happy with this. This sounds like inflammatory arthritis. Then I think you've got all you need. What we know about any test, an examination as a test, is that the utility of that test depends on your pre-test probability. And if your pre-test probability is really high, then requesting a test doesn't really add an awful lot. And if as an experienced GP, you listen to somebody's story and say, do you know what? The classical, you know, sort of 28-year-old woman, postnatal, who's developed new onset small joint pain and swelling, that to me is enough to make a referral. People often ask me about blood tests and how blood tests can help. And I think this is sometimes a little bit controversial, but my feeling is that actually blood tests don't help us in the diagnosis of inflammatory arthritis. Why do I say that? Well, we know that particularly in early disease, blood tests will be completely normal in a third of people. So a third of people with new inflammatory arthritis have a normal CRP and a normal full blood count. So if you are relying on blood tests to make that decision for you and thinking, if they've got a normal CRP, they can't have inflammatory arthritis, you will be wrong a third of the time. When I see people in clinic, in secondary care clinic, blood tests are helpful if I've made a diagnosis of inflammatory arthritis and I'm looking to start treatment. They can be helpful in guiding that and helping me prognosticate, work out how aggressive an arthritis might be, work out what the right treatment might be. But in terms of diagnosis, I don't think blood tests or x-rays are useful.
So that's really useful to know, actually. And I think that is sometimes a change in my practice, because although I do tend to refer with negative blood tests, I often wait for them to come back for the referral, whereas maybe I should be doing the referral earlier and saying that the blood tests will be back by the time they've seen.
That's a really important point. So if we think about that 6 week, that sort of 3 month window of opportunity, the nice guidance here is that inflammatory arthritis should be referred within 3 working days of presentation. And we know that as a nation across the UK, we're not hitting that. So back in 2016, we were at less than 20%. I think thanks to the Royal College and the work the Royal College has been doing and Versus Arthritis have been doing and prioritising this as a problem, we've improved that. We're now up to about 40%, so 2 in 5 people. But that still means 2/3 of people, there or thereabouts, aren't referred in within that timescale. So we should be viewing this in the same way we view a 2 week wait referral. That if we think somebody has inflammatory arthritis, we need to be referring that early, we need to be referring that urgently within 3 working days. And if we wait for blood tests, not only will that impair our clinical decision making, but it just adds that extra delay. When we think about that window of opportunity to treat somebody's arthritis, we're just building delay in each step.
Yeah, so that's a key message. Do the blood test, but do the referral at the same time and just make sure the consultant can see them. So what bloods would you do initially if you are in primary care, you're doing your referral and you think you'll do some bloods at the same time to help the consultant when they see the patient?
Yeah, so I think there are certain things which are really helpful when you see somebody. So I think about them in 2 different ways. The first thing is, if I'm going to be starting somebody on DMARDs, there are things that I need really to make that decision. And they're really straightforward. You know, that's somebody's kidney function, that's an LFT and a full blood count, because they help me make a decision about what treatment I might or might not use. The other blood tests that are really useful are blood tests that help me prognosticate, so help me work out how aggressive somebody's arthritis might be. And this is one where CRP is helpful, because we know that a raised CRP is associated with a poorer outcome. And the higher your CRP, the worse you tend to do. The greater the area under that curve, the higher your CRP, and the longer it's been high for, the worse you tend to do. So I would tend to treat somebody more aggressively if they have a high CRP. The other tests that can be useful are rheumatoid factor and CCP antibody. So again, we know that at diagnosis, these will be negative in at least a third of people. So it doesn't help me make a diagnosis. If I've made a diagnosis of inflammatory arthritis and they have either a positive rheumatoid factor or a positive CCP antibody, that puts them in a group of people who tend to do poorly, whose arthritis is more aggressive, who may erode early and have early joint damage. So again, that would be a prompt to me to treat them more aggressively. So particularly CCP antibody is associated with erosion and aggressive disease. And there may be some subsets of rheumatoid factor that might increase your disease sort of aggressiveness and how aggressive your disease is. And we think about there may be some changes coming through IgA and IgM subsets of rheumatoid factor that might change how we alter people's management. So they're the tests that are helpful. There are, you know, our simple baseline blood tests, which help me prior to making a decision about a DMARD, help me prescribe that safely and quickly. And then there are also antibody tests, which help me prognosticate.
Thanks, that's really useful. So I know that patients with RA have a higher cardiovascular risk. Would you test lipids and HbA1c in any patient that you're referring, or would you risk stratify for those who have other cardiovascular risks?
So I think I'd risk stratify. So what I would do in that case, being honest, the majority of people over the age of 50, particularly when people over the age of 65, they'll tend to be having them done for other reasons. Most people either have hypertension, CKD, diabetes, they'll be picking that up as part of their annual review. So I wouldn't request them as a routine. But they can be helpful when you're doing somebody's rheumatoid review. We know that people with rheumatoid arthritis, their risk of cardiovascular disease is of a similar magnitude to people with diabetes. So your relative risk goes up about four times as soon as you develop inflammatory arthritis. They can help us risk assess and think about statins and primary prevention, but I might not necessarily at diagnosis be requesting them.
And is there any point in x-raying in primary care if I see someone who looks like they've got synovitis of their small joints of their hand? Is there any point in x-raying both hands at the same time as sending them off on a referral?
So I think this is a very much a local decision. So I know that when I see people in clinic, I've got an x-ray room next door. So they come into me, essentially we run a one-stop shop. I diagnose them with rheumatoids. They get their chest x-ray, they get their blood tests, they get x-rays of their hands and feet, they get pulmonary function tests, and they get started on a DMARD the same day. But that might not be the same across the UK. So if you know that there might be a significant wait to see a rheumatologist, or they might be seeing them in a community hospital where they haven't got access to x-ray, your colleagues might be very grateful if the x-rays are done prior to seeing them. For most people, they'd be going for a trip to a rheumatologist to see them face to face. So they may as well get their x-rays done at that time. But that's a very personal decision, and that depends on your local availability of testing.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense with pathways changing. So some people are seen in the community. Now, would you ever treat the patient at the time of a referral? Obviously, you're going to give them some analgesia, maybe a non-steroidal or cocodamol or something similar. But is there a role for a short course of prednisolone at the time of referral?
It's a really hard question, this, isn't it? Because I think your innate human nature is to help people. And when you sit in front of somebody and think, blimey, they've got awful new rheumatoid, and I know that steroids will make them feel better tomorrow, your natural response is to say, I just want to help you feel better. And I think this is where we get into a little bit of difficulty. So in an ideal world, I would say no. And I would say no because ideally, these patients are going to be seen quickly. They're going to be seen inside 2 weeks. And if I see somebody in secondary care in rheumatology clinic who's been started on steroids, that makes it almost impossible to know what their underlying diagnosis is. In an ideal world, we can see everybody within the timescale that we want. I would say no, because it's just going to add delay and make things more difficult. But, so if your local service is such that you know there's a significant delay, and you know that this patient isn't going to be seen for a significant number of months, then that's when you might want to start thinking about it. But I think I would caveat that by saying, have a conversation with your local rheumatologist. I think if you've got somebody with awful disease, and you know that your colleagues are struggling, as we are, I think contacting them and saying, look, you know, I've got this person here, I've got florid synovitis, I know this is inflammatory arthritis, and we're the best one in the world, I know you're not going to see them for 2-3 months, and your colleagues might say, look, let's just manage this pragmatically. Let's just be as pragmatic as we can and manage the patient sat in front of us. But for the vast majority of people and the vast majority of circumstances, I would say please avoid steroids because it makes life in secondary care very difficult, and actually it just adds a delay to that patient because they're going to have to come off the steroids at some point so we can see them and confirm that diagnosis.
That absolutely makes sense, and I don't really like starting big doses of steroids without talking to rheumatologists, and I'm lucky that our local rheumatologists are very accessible on email or the phone, so that does help. And presumably there would never be a case where as a GP you would start a DMARD in primary care.
I can't imagine a circumstance where it's in somebody's interest to commence a DMARD in primary care, and I think that's, you know, important for a couple of reasons. I think from the patient's point of view, they're important safety things. We need to be certain about a diagnosis, and I think that's sometimes difficult to do in primary care. You know, experienced rheumatologists with MRI and ultrasound and all the things that we have available in secondary care sometimes struggle to make a diagnosis. I think medically, legally as well, it is, you're on slightly dodgy grounds in that the national picture and that the, you know, the experts have said, look, this is something that's best prescribed with shared care, started in secondary care, started by a rheumatologist, with monitoring in primary care. And I think if you're stepping outside of that, then you are leaving yourself exposed should there be a problem in the future. So my personal view would be to avoid that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We do sometimes get slightly left field requests to start things from consultants often in the private sector, but I completely agree that I wouldn't be comfortable doing this. So we've seen the patient, we've referred them, we've done some basic bloods at the same time, and they've got to clinic and they're seeing you or one of your colleagues. What investigations is the patient likely to have in secondary care?
So I think increasingly at diagnosis, they're likely to have an ultrasound. And that's usually a bedside ultrasound done by a rheumatologist for a couple of reasons. Ultrasound is better than our fingers at picking up synovitis. So if you're not certain, and we often see people in whom we're not certain, either the history is not characteristic. Sometimes osteoarthritis and rheumatoid can be difficult to tell apart. Sometimes with obesity, it can be difficult to feel people's joints. Your fingers just aren't sensitive enough. So ultrasound can help us in that regard, can pick up subtle synovitis. It's also really, really good at picking up early erosion. So it's more sensitive than x-ray in picking up early joint damage. And that gives us a big piece of prognostic information about who we need to treat aggressively. Sometimes we might go on and request other forms of imaging like MRI if we're not certain. And then we talked about x-ray and usually the pre-DMARD tests. So chest x-ray, x-ray hands and feet, pulmonary function tests. And we often think about other things as well. So you know, the things that I have ready access to in secondary care that I don't in primary care. I sit in an outpatient department where I've got a physiotherapist in the room next to me who can see people urgently if needs be. I've got fantastic occupational therapy colleagues who can see people and help with function, with hand function, with mobility. I've got clinical nurse specialists who can help counsel about DMARDs, but also do the things that I think nurses are better at than we are, thinking about the sort of lifestyle and impacts on people's lives. So that's often what people might gain from seeing us in secondary care.
So the patient's been referred, they've been diagnosed. Clearly, all the decisions about treatment, doses of DMARDs and so on, they're all going to be made in secondary care. But what's my role as a GP with a patient who is having ongoing monitoring and treatment for their RA?
So I think this, again, is classical primary care, isn't it? It's being holistic. It's about thinking about the things outside of purely their joints that I think as GPs we do really well. There are a number of different things. So when we talk and train our juniors to think about how to do a good rheumatoid arthritis review, I tend to think about it in a couple of different areas. The first one is the drugs. So we're good. So we've got very good IT systems that can look at compliance, can be a flag about people's side effects and whether they're getting on with the drugs well and having their regular monitoring. We know that problems with mental health, with depression and anxiety, are more common in people with a chronic disease, particularly in inflammatory arthritis. So I think screening for depression and anxiety is something that we should undertake in a rheumatoid arthritis review. And that could be as simple as doing a PHQ-2, you know, if you felt down, depressed and hopeless, and do you still enjoy doing the things that you normally do? I think screening for cardiovascular disease is important. We've already mentioned that. We've already touched on the fact that people with rheumatoid in particular, their cardiovascular risk increases by a factor of 4. So doing a Q-risk 2 is important. And I think doing a FRAX score as well is important. Thinking about somebody's fracture risk. Do they need a DEXA scan? Are they somebody in whom we should be thinking about doing a bone health check in more detail?
Thank you. It's good to think about the, as you say, the things outside the joints, the more holistic thing. Can we talk a little bit about the details of shared care and how well that works? You've probably had experience of it working well and of it not working well. What are the points in a shared care agreement do you think that would make it work well?
So I think with all of these things, you know, the key thing is good communication. And I think it's communication in two different ways. I think it's having clear roles and responsibilities and knowing who manages what. But I think there's also a degree of trust that's involved, isn't there? That this idea that we trust each other and we trust ourselves to manage things well. So I think secondary care can help by being really clear about prescribing decisions. So being clear about when we're making a change, why we're making it. And by making sure that we're doing that in a timely way, that we're not putting extra pressure on primary care. I think what primary care is good at is managing our patients in a timely and a local way. I think certainly I work in a rural area, so I think often our patients really struggle to get into secondary care. So I think taking some of that burden off them is important. So I think primary care should be really clear that they are making decisions about prescribing and dose change. We're generalists in primary care. We're not experts in managing these conditions. We're not experts in managing these drugs. But where I think primary care should take responsibility is in the day-to-day monitoring, so looking at blood tests, taking blood tests, and reporting any anomalies into secondary care.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And it is so important to have open lines of communication. So moving away from blood tests to other tests, my computer occasionally flashes up a warning when patients are on hydroxychloroquine that have I thought about doing an eye test. And I must say, it's not something I ever tend to do. I always assume the consultant will handle it, but I'm a bit concerned that they might be thinking that I'll do that. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, again, I think this is something that's difficult to generalise across the UK because there will be different local guidelines in place. Hydroxychloroquine can very rarely cause problems with the back of your eye with maculopathy and macular deposits. The problem with that is you see them on a scan, but they very rarely have clinical relevance. The thing that we need to think about is people having visual change. So that's the key symptom. If somebody has visual change on hydroxychloroquine, they need to see an optician and potentially an ophthalmologist very quickly. So our local guidance is that once people have been on hydroxychloroquine for 5 years, our ophthalmologists have agreed that they should have what we call an OCT scan. I'm not an ophthalmologist. I don't understand the whys and wherefores of that. But it's a fancy scan that looks for maculopathy and deposits. But we're all in agreement that I think as rheumatologists and ophthalmologists, I think our feeling is that the risk of this is potentially a little bit overblown. Again, being contentious, this might be driven by practice in the States, where there's a getting people into clinic, you know, potentially drives income. So I think our feeling is that's driven by a little bit by practice in the US. So we've agreed locally that we'll once people have been on hydroxychloroquine for 5 years, they should be referred onto the ophthalmologist for a scan, and they can then be seen very infrequently after that. But that depends on local variations. Different rheumatologists and different ophthalmologists might disagree, might have different local pathways. I think a lot depends on the clinical pressure in ophthalmology departments, because this is a huge volume of work which they may struggle to fit in. So I think, again, if you had concerns, I think what I'd be doing is having a conversation with your local rheumatology team and certainly looking at your local shared care guidelines, because almost certainly this will have been discussed and hopefully a pathway agreed.
That's really useful. Thank you very much. So I think we've pretty much talked about everything now. We've taken the patient right through from their initial presentation, their referral, what's going to be done in secondary care, and what we can do as GPs. So I'd like to say a big thank you to Danny Murphy, GP partner, staff grade rheumatologist, and Versus Arthritis MSK champion. Thank you to you for listening to this RCGP podcast on rheumatoid arthritis.